Good morning, and the conversation begins here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. It is cold out there, and it's only going to go up into the low 60s today. So no matter where you go, you'll take hot conversation with you here on 94 WIP. And when we come back, the election's around the corner. What does it mean? What are the implications? Does it make a difference? We're going to ask these and other questions of my guest coming up in just a bit, author Bill Schneider, his new book, How America Became Ungovernable. All this and more coming up here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. More in just a bit. And we're back. It's Conversation. Our conversation this morning here on 94 WIP is with author, political expert Bill Schneider, his new book, Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. Good morning, Bill Schneider.
Good morning.
Do you really believe that we're ungovernable as a country?
Well, look what's happening. Not very much. The Republicans are in charge of everything, the presidency, the Congress, and now the Supreme Court, and most state governments. And the president can't get the one thing that he promised when he ran for president in 2016. He can't get them to build a wall. His own party won't give him that. Some things get done, but a lot of things just can't really get done because there's no compromise between the two sides.
How did we get to that place? Because it used to be compromise.
Our government works through compromise. I remember once there was a Tea Party rally, and Bill Clinton was there. It was actually a political meeting with a lot of Tea Party voters there. And he talked about the genius of compromise, which is required by the Constitution. And a woman got up, and she was very angry. She said, "I don't believe in compromise. Compromise means selling out. I think you should stand up for what you believe." And President Clinton's response was, "Madam, read the Constitution. It might as well be called, Let's Make a Deal." Well, the fact is, it's very hard to make a deal these days.
I find it kind of ironic we're doing this interview this morning because it is also the birthday of one of our presidential great compromisers, at least from my memory, and that's Dwight David Eisenhower, President Eisenhower.
Yes.
A good compromiser. And we've really drifted far away.
Yeah, we really have. I mean, he was a moderate Republican, a very popular figure, a military hero. But his style of Republican politics, which is basically a problem-solving style, he would take problems as they came up, whether they were the challenge of the Soviet Union, the Sputnik, and he would deal with them one at a time without any ideology or dogma getting in the way. He was a Republican, but he was a moderate Republican. Nowadays, the extremes have really become much more powerful.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because starting about 50 years ago, the 1960s, we had two groups really emerge. One is what I call the new America. These were groups that were just beginning to develop political consciousness in the 60s. Young people, minorities, immigrants, working women who had begun to enter the labor force for the first time. Descendants of immigrants, gay people began to appear in politics for the first time. And there was a backlash, and also, of course, most importantly, African Americans. That was the Civil Rights Movement. And there was a backlash to all of that on the right. This was happening all over the world, but in the United States, the backlash was more severe because there was something unique about the United States, and it really does shape our politics. That is, the United States of America is the most religious industrial society in the world. No other country in Europe or even Canada matches the United States in the seriousness with which we take religion. And the political backlash to the emergence of the new America, that really was based on religion. And right now, if you want to find out if a person is a Democrat or Republican, and you don't just ask them, are you a Democrat or Republican, the best way to do that is to say, how often do you go to church? Regular churchgoers tend to vote Republican, and non-churchgoers vote Democratic.
Mm. You really think, though, that we're the most religious, given some of the Muslim countries?
No, I said industrial society.
Oh, okay.
I haven't seen any figures for Iran, but certainly Europe, Canada, even Latin America, the churches are empty in most of those places. In the United States, the reason why we're so religious is that a lot of the people who came here in the early days came here seeking religious freedom, starting with the Puritans who settled in Massachusetts. Religious freedom was very important. 200 years later, it was Jewish Americans or Jews who came here seeking religious freedom. If you come here seeking religious freedom, you're likely to be very religious.
Hmm. Can we translate the whole problem into one of fear?
Fear?
Yeah. We're afraid of the change. We're afraid that we're going to lose control.
Well, I don't know that I would call it fear. I would say that what's really underneath our politics today is differences of values. In the past, politics was always about interests. And one of the big themes in my book is how we've gone from a politics of interests that can be negotiated and compromised to a politics of values, which is about right and wrong. And when you have conflicts of values, it's very hard to make deals or to compromise because you don't want to compromise what you feel is absolutely right.
Hmm. Can you give me an example of how you think that's played itself out politically?
Yeah. Here's a pattern we've just noticed in American politics. You've noticed in the last few years, although it's been building over time. The wealthier you are, the more likely you are to vote Republican. That's interests. You vote your economic interest. But what's happened in the last 50 years is the better educated you are, the more likely you are to vote Democratic. That really started with people like Eugene McCarthy and George McGovern, and now it's become Obama was the peak of that. Obama was the prince of education. Mitt Romney was the prince of wealth. We have two different elites in this country, an elite of education and an elite of wealth, and they're at war with each other. That's one of the reasons why it's very difficult to get anything done. And the differences by education are largely about values. And right now, in this year's midterm election, you're seeing Republicans struggling to keep their hold on affluent, well-educated suburban voters who really don't like Donald Trump and who are fleeing the Republican Party.
Even with all the Christian, and I say Christian because they primarily seem to me to be Christian institutions of higher education?
Well, there are a lot of Christian institutions, and usually they produce people who take religion very seriously. But I think most people who go to college these days don't go to religious institutions. Some of them have religious sponsorship, but that doesn't mean that religion is a large part of the curriculum. It is in some cases. But education breeds, generally, liberal cultural values. And we're finding bigger and bigger differences between college graduates and non-college graduates all over the country. And that's affecting our politics.
All right. What do we do about it?
Well, we certainly don't want a less well-educated society. We're divided. Everybody can see that. And it makes it very difficult to solve problems. One of the things that creates the problem of not being very governable is we have a constitution written in the 1780s that provides for limited government. Americans like limited government. We don't like strong government. It's part of our tradition. And what that means is it's automatically difficult to get things done because there's so much division. You have checks and balances in the Constitution. You have differences between the federal government and the states, which sometimes go to war figuratively with each other. The states will challenge the federal government. They're doing it right now on the issue of climate change. It's very easy to block things from happening in the United States. How do you get things to actually happen? Well, the dirty little secret in American politics is when there is a real crisis, when people feel a sense of urgency, as they did after 9/11, as they did during the civil rights crisis of the 1960s, as they did during after the financial crash in 2008, when people feel a sense of urgency and they stand up and they say to the government, you better get this problem solved or you're going to be thrown out of office, then politicians act. The system works very, very well in a crisis. The problem is it requires a crisis.
Are we getting there yet?
No one knows. People are always predicting crises. We have, in our politics, because the system works very well in a crisis, we have political figures who are constantly going around the country and declaring a war on something. We had a war on poverty, we had a war on drugs, we had a war on crime, we had a war on terror. Sometimes those things are real and people respond to them that way. They're ready to be led, they're ready to accept solutions. Sometimes they're just wars declared by politicians. I remember President Gerald Ford once declared a war on inflation. No one knew what he was talking about. A lot of people didn't understand what Bush was talking about when he talked about a war on terror. How are we supposed to fight a war on terror? Those kinds of emergencies are really the norm in American politics for people, for leaders to talk about. My job has always been to tell when the crisis is real and urgent and when it really isn't.
All right. How about the war for control of American society, which is happening right now? Republicans
yes.
wanting us to go one way and Democrats another.
That is a war, but it's a war with that between the two sides. It's not a war that all Americans acknowledge. There are lots of Democrats right now who feel that this country has been taken over by conservatives, by a religious movement, by Republicans, and they're not happy with it. And they're ready to go to battle, and they're prepared to do that in just a few weeks in the midterm election, which will decide, you know, whether President Trump will be invigorated by a big Republican victory, or whether if Democrats take control even of the House of Representatives in Congress, their mission will be to stop this president from doing anything.
But to stay in power, don't the Republicans have to start doing something?
Of course. And right now the economy is going very well. The great mystery is, if the economy is doing so well, why isn't President Trump doing better? Well, he is doing well with some constituencies. A lot of business people like him. Even some minorities are very favorable to President Trump because, look, they say the economy is good, therefore the president must be doing his job. And that is usually the test. The problem is, this president is unique in one major respect. He divides the country. He deliberately divides the country. He succeeded four presidents in a row who promised to be healers, who promised to bring the country together. The first president, Bush, said he was kinder and gentler. He got fired after one term. Bill Clinton was a new Democrat in the third way. He got impeached. The second president, Bush, said, "I'm a uniter, not a divider." He ended up dividing the country bitterly over the war in Iraq. And President Obama said there's no liberal America and no conservative America. But guess what? He was wrong. There is a liberal and a conservative America, the blue and the red. Every one of them failed. What's unique about Donald Trump is he never proposed to be a healer. He never proposed that he had the formula for bringing Americans together. He was elected as a divider, and he's governing the country as a divider, and a lot of Americans resent that.
But can we really say the economy, and I know you're not an economist, but can we really say the economy is doing so well, given that loud thud we heard on Friday afternoon from the stock market?
Well, the stock market is gyrating. It always does. And I'm not sure the stock market is the best measure of the economy. The unemployment rate is lower than it's been in about 30 years. There's a lot of growth. We're about 4% growth, which we could only dream of 10 years ago after the financial crash. Sure, there are a lot of problems. There are a lot of people who feel left out of the growing economy. But ordinarily, if the economy were doing this well, the president would be immensely popular. He's not, because his style of governing angers and turns off so many voters.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning for Conversation, Bill Schneider, a leading political analyst. He's covered American politics and presidential elections since 1964. His new book, Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. My name's Peter Solomon. Would you say the recent hearings to confirm Associate Justice Kavanaugh is an example of our governability or our ungovernability?
Ungovernability more than anything else. He did get confirmed, but it was a real struggle for him to get confirmed, and it was the closest confirmation vote for a Supreme Court justice in, I think, over 100 years. It was even closer than the vote for Clarence Thomas, which was another case where we were deeply divided. The issues that the Supreme Court deals with are social issues. Now, they're the most controversial. And there are issues like abortion, women's rights, gay rights, same-sex marriage. Those are the core issues that divide the new America and the old America. And when he was nominated by President Trump, a lot of Americans, particularly women, became very fearful that they were going to, and most Americans felt that that rights were going to be lost, that the Supreme Court would have a conservative majority and reverse maybe even the Roe v. Wade decision from 1973 that gave constitutional protection to women's right to have an abortion. They were afraid that they'd be backsliding. And the result was it became one of the ugliest and most bitter confirmation fights we've ever had, and it's created a greater division than ever between men and women, and we're going to see that play out in the November election.
You think it's going to hurt those sitting senators in particular who are going to run for re-election in November?
It may hurt some of them, but many of them are running in very Republican states, and if they're Democrats, of course, that could be a big problem. At least one Democrat in North Dakota looks like she's probably going to go down to defeat. It made both sides very angry. And in the Senate races, the Democrats tend to be more vulnerable simply because one-third of the Senate seats are up this year, and the particular seats that are up this year are in states that are quite conservative, North Dakota, West Virginia, Missouri, and those states are basically red states. And they have Democratic senators whose seats are up this year. Why do they have Democratic senators? Well, because 12 years ago, those seats are up every 6 years. 12 years ago, Democrats won those seats because of anger over the war in Iraq. And they kept those seats 6 years ago when we had an election that returned Barack Obama to office for a second term. This year, it's going to be a real struggle because not only are Democrats activated, but a lot of Republicans are activated, too, to defend President Trump. And when they have to vote, they're going to vote Republican.
You think that Republicans, in particular Republican women, though, are going to vote for Trump even with what happened with Kavanaugh?
No, I don't think a lot of – well, if they're Republican women, yes, they will. What we're seeing in the polls is that Kavanaugh's confirmation did divide men and women to some extent, but it really divided Republicans and Democrats, so that Republican women tend, on the whole, to remain voting Republican. Their party is a bigger issue than their gender, and men are amongst President Trump's strongest supporters.
I guess it's me, but I just find that puzzling, considering the implications of voting for Justice Kavanaugh and playing it out in terms of whether women are to be believed or not when they scream sexual assault.
It is interesting that you see a division between men and women, but the division between Republicans and Democrats over Judge Kavanaugh has always been much greater. Everything today is partisan, even the economy. Republicans think the economy is gangbusters and the whole country is prospering and there's nothing to complain about. Democrats believe the economy is terrible and we're all going to go to hell and that Trump has exhibited very little leadership. They differ. Even if you ask them, how are things going today, they'll differ enormously because everything has become partisan. I had a student once who asked in class, is this the most divided we've ever been as a country? And my answer was, you know, we did once have a civil war. 750,000 Americans died in the Civil War. We're nowhere close to anything like that. But this is probably the most divided we've been as a country since the Civil War, and it's very bitter.
Yeah. Just your saying that reminds me when President Trump said there may be violence in the streets if he's not supported in the midterm election.
Yes, he has a tendency to say things like that. And sometimes to talk about violent backlash against the Democrats. When he goes to a rally, which is what he loves to do, I believe that he doesn't really enjoy being president. What he enjoys is campaigning. He enjoys going to these huge, worshipful rallies, which he's doing several times a week now before the election. He loves that because he feels the energy of the crowd, the adoration of the crowd. He likes campaigning. I'm not sure he really enjoys governing.
I was intrigued to see, continuing with the Kavanaugh confirmation a little bit longer, dark money paid for a thank you ad to Senator Collins from Maine for her vote for Kavanaugh.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of money going into Maine now, both in favor of Senator Collins and against her, because she's one of the few moderate Republicans left in this country, and her vote was on the line, and she cast the deciding vote to confirm Justice Kavanaugh. Well, she's not on the ballot this year. She's on the ballot in 2020. But already, Democrats and liberals are piling up money to give to anyone who opposes her in 2020, and they don't even know who it's going to be yet. But if they want to try to make her vulnerable to force her to pay for her vote for Justice Kavanaugh, even though she's a Republican and voted with the rest of her party.
You're suggesting that the Democrats in Maine would vote for Daffy Duck if he ran against her.
Well, I don't know about that, but the Democrats in Maine, whatever happens, they're unlikely to support Susan Collins, and a number of them have supported her in the past. I think that has ended with her vote to confirm Justice Kavanaugh.
So her vote was a calculated risk.
It was a calculated risk. Now, look, 2 years is an eternity in politics. A British prime minister once said, a week is a long time in politics. Let me tell you something. I study a lot of demographics in the United States, political demographics. Everybody knows that the population trends favor Democrats. The groups that are growing in size and influence are descendants of immigrants. They're young people who are moving into the electorate. More and more gay people are coming out of the closet. You have a lot more Latinos, African Americans. The groups that are growing tend to be groups that are becoming more Democratic, including one group that Democrats never talk about. But what we see going on in the polls is that there is a growing number of Americans who are unchurched. These are people who, when you ask them, are you Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, Mormon, or something else, they say, I'm not affiliated with any organized religion. That's now about a quarter of the country. Used to be maybe 7% back in the 60s. It's now close to 25%, and they are very strong Democrats. That group is growing. The problem is demographics is long. Politics is short. So when you tell that to Democrats, they have to ask, and they do ask, how long is this going to take for the Democrats to have a natural majority? It could take decades or more. In the long run, things look good for Democrats, but they got to win this year.
And if they don't win this year?
They will be very demoralized, and they'll try to organize. They're already organizing a movement to nominate someone who can beat Donald Trump. But Democrats are facing a real problem. Do they want a Democratic Donald Trump, someone who imitates his style, who's feisty, who's combative, and who's just as divisive as Donald Trump? Well, they might have one. You ever hear of Donald Avenatti? Not Donald. Michael Avenatti. Michael Avenatti. Who is the lawyer for Stormy Daniels. He is actively running for the Democratic nomination. He has no political experience, no experience in government. He says he will run because he's the only Democrat around who can take on Donald Trump and fight on his turf. And that may yet be true, but I'm not sure that's what Democrats want. The other model is someone who's running this year and who may not, so far it doesn't look like he's going to win the seat. That's Beto O'Rourke, the Democratic candidate for senator from Kentucky, running against Ted Cruz. He has not been ahead in a single poll, but he thrills Democrats. Millions of Democrats saw the statement that he made at the Democratic State Convention about the football players who take a knee before football games during the national anthem. He was inspiring. He had a sense of purpose, and a lot of Democrats are falling in love with him. The problem is, he may not win in Texas, and there's no indication that he will. Texas doesn't have a single statewide elected Democratic official, hasn't since 1994.
Well, in that particular election, will they be voting for Mr. O'Rourke, or are they likely to be voting against Ted Cruz?
Well, both. Democrats hate Ted Cruz, and they love Beto O'Rourke. The problem is he's got to win a party that doesn't vote. Democrats in Texas are the party of non-voters. Republicans control the state, and there are lots of blockages to voting in Texas. A lot of people can't register. You have to bring ID to the polls. So he has to really mobilize the party of the non-voters, and that's a very difficult thing to do, particularly in a midterm election when there's no presidential race on the ballot. A lot of people don't feel motivated to vote.
Not literally on the ballot, but figuratively on the ballot.
the president is figuratively on the ballot, but
yes,
a lot of voters, you know, they don't see the name Donald Trump. They look at this list of names of local officials. They don't know any of them, and they don't know what it is they're voting for. So you always get a big drop in turnout in the midterm, and that tends to hurt Democrats.
Perhaps like never before, social media, the internet, the computer, it seems to be making a major, major impact on our elections, doesn't it?
That's absolutely right. Social media are a way of voters communicating with each other. It rallies voters. It can hurt a candidate because you can spread rumors by social media. We know now that the Russians interfered with social media coverage in 2016, and they're still trying to interfere with our elections. They're creating divisions because they want to see the United States continue to divide bitterly. Russians would be very happy because they know that weakens the United States. But even without Russian interference, we're now finding that poisonous messages, nastiness, hate, comes from Americans, from American groups, you know, who hate. The left hates the right hates the left, and the internet makes it very easy to reach large numbers of people because the internet isn't edited by anybody. Nobody checks to see whether, when you post on the internet, what you're saying is actually true. There's a lot of misinformation on the internet, and as a result, the role of the professional media, broadcast television and newspapers and magazines, is diminished because people are paying attention to the kind of loud, poisonous messages that they're getting on the internet.
Well, here in Pennsylvania, this is an example, we have a governor's race, and the Republican candidate for governor is threatening to step on the face of the Democratic governor with his golf shoes.
That's the sort of thing you see on the internet all the time. A lot of voters know to disregard that, but not a lot of people don't know that. And when it comes time to vote, they'll often vote their fears or their anger. And what the internet does is it allows voters and organized groups to stir up a lot of fear and anger. That's always been the case in our politics, but now there's an easy way to do it. The internet makes that much easier to do than it ever was in the past, and it even allows other countries to interfere in our elections.
And to continue to interfere because there's evidence now, but nobody seems to be doing anything.
Well, the question is, technically, what can you do? I mean, Facebook claims that it's getting rid of websites that are sponsored with foreign money. They're doing what they can. But a lot of this isn't foreign. A lot of this is American money that's paying for ads, that's paying for shows that are very difficult, that make our politics very ugly and very difficult. There's nothing you can do because we have freedom of speech in this country. The internet gives people a way to promote their views, to advocate their positions without anybody really checking whether they're telling the truth or not, whether there's any foundation for what they're saying.
You remind me of a saying my daddy used to have. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it think.
That's true.
And that's really kind of frightening. We're also making voting harder to do. The recent Supreme Court decision supporting a voter identification law in one of the states. What do you think about that?
Well, we've always had, not always, for the last 150 years, we've made it more and more difficult to vote in this country because people worry about voter fraud, which isn't a huge problem. But you talk to Republicans, and they'll say there's millions of fraudulent voters. Very few of them, after careful research, very few people have been charged with fraudulent voting. It's not that important an activity for most Americans that they're going to break the law in order to get it done. It is for some people, but it's not that big a deal. You know, until around the turn of the 20th century, over 100 years ago, in most states, you didn't have to register to vote. You just showed up, and you were allowed to vote. Well, there was so much fraud when we had political machines and very close competition in elections that the authorities decided we want to clean this up. Progressives came along and they said we want to make sure only the right people vote, and they started passing rules and regulations like being forced to register to vote several weeks before the election. I know I'm in Washington, D.C. right now, and I'm constantly hearing ads. If you want to vote in the state of Virginia, which is a swing state, then you've got to register before Monday. A lot of people haven't been thinking about that, but you do have to do that, and this is the only country I know of where people have to take the initiative to put their names on the voter rolls themselves. The government doesn't do that. The government will keep up to date tax rolls, but the government does not keep up to date voter registration rolls. The citizens have to do that on their own, and a lot of them don't.
You think that's a deliberate act on the part of the government?
Well, it was supposed to clean up politics, and that certainly was deliberate, because there was so much fraud at the time of the big machines. I'm talking Tammany Hall, mm-hmm. back in the late 19th and early 20th century. And it did clean up politics considerably. But nowadays, more restrictions have been placed on voting, in part because of resistance to the rise of the New America. The New America includes a lot of immigrant groups, a lot of groups that seem unfamiliar. And the result is that conservatives and Republicans in many states are imposing more and tougher restrictions on eligibility to vote. You have to show an ID. It has to be a picture ID. You have to register earlier and earlier. They've made it tougher to vote in many cases. That's sort of part of the political warfare that's going on between the left and the right, the red and the blue in the United States.
Well, in all fairness, though, to the more conservative perspective on voting, for years in Philadelphia, we used to talk about the cemetery vote. The dead shall rise on election day.
That's right. I remember in Illinois, they always talk about how the dead people vote in Chicago. People always talk about that, and they think it's a huge problem. But every research that's done by professionals at universities, it always shows that voter fraud is a minor problem. It rarely happens because for most people, voting is not all that big a deal. It's not so important. They're not going to make money by voting. Although I do remember a wonderful story I saw on television about voter fraud in Georgia. And in one county in Georgia, they interviewed a woman who said somebody paid her to cast the vote a certain way. They said, look, I'll go vote for you, and I'll pay you if you let me do that. And the woman said, fine. And when she was told that that's against the law, she said, how can it be against the law? It's my vote. I'll sell it if I want to. It belongs to me. That's an interesting point.
Well, and then there are those people who would probably take the money and go do what they want anyway.
That's probably true. But they say, I'll vote for you, and I'll pay you for that privilege. Just give me your voting card. Well, there is some of that in this country, and there always has been. There probably always will be. But the idea that our election system is completely fouled by fraudulent voting, that's a real big overstatement.
And you're listening to 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning on Conversation, Bill Schneider, author of the new book, Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. My name's Peter Solomon. Be a part of the discussion. Give us a call. You know the number. Ring that phone. Get your questions answered. Make your point. All right, so we've talked about values and how it hits upon us. We've talked about the rise of the new America. People want something when they vote. But not a lot of people want anything, do they?
Very often they want government to let them alone, and they'll vote for the party that promises to do precisely that. Politics is not central to most people's lives in the United States. What's central to most people's lives is making a living and religion. Those are the things that people consider most important. This country isn't driven by politics. And the fact is, we even elect people who are not politicians because we think politics is the enemy of problem solving. Why can't we get the deficit reduced? Because of politics. Why can't we deal with climate change? Because politics gets involved. So Americans are always attracted to people who aren't professional politicians. And we have one in office right now, Donald Trump. He has never run for anything, did not serve in the military. The first president who's never done those things. I remember back in the 90s, a lot of Americans fell in love with Ross Perot, another businessman who had never been involved in politics. The message that these outsiders deliver is, I can solve the problems in this country because I'll keep politics out of it. And then they discover, you know what, you can't do that. I keep getting asked when I give talks around the country, why can't we run government like a business? If government were run like a business, and of course Trump is a businessman, so is Ross Perot, if government were run like a business, we could get problems solved because we could keep politics out of it. As everyone knows, of course, there's no politics in business. At least people believe that. And my answer, which I try to explain as carefully as possible, is the reason we can't run government like a business is business is not a democracy. If business were run as a democracy, it would look like government. It would be inefficient. It would be divided. So we can't really do that. But people honestly believe we can, and that's why we're always falling for people, for politicians, for candidates who are outsiders.
All right, another issue that gets people tense, bordering on violence in some cases, is gun control.
Oh, yeah. Well, gun control has been an issue for a long time. And that's an issue where you have a constituency. It's not a majority, but there's a constituency of gun owners and gun activists, gun rights activists, who are extremely intense in their commitment to gun rights. And they tell politicians, if you don't vote the right way, which is to support gun rights, we're going to come after you and we're going to throw you out of office. And they do that all the time, all over the country. If you're a politician, and let's say you're a member of Congress, and you take a poll in your district, and the poll shows that three-quarters of the voters in your district support gun control measures like background checks, which we could not pass after the Sandy Hook tragedy in 2012. Is it safe to vote for background checks? Actually, no, because you're not going to gain many votes from the three-quarters of the voters in your constituency who agree with you on the issue. They don't vote that issue. They vote a lot of other things. But the one-quarter of your constituents who hate the idea of gun control and who want you to protect their gun rights, they're going to get angry. They feel very intensely about it. It drives their vote, and they're going to vote against you for that reason alone. So even though there's a majority with you, they don't vote the issue. And the result is you're going to lose more votes on the issue than you'll gain.
But yet at the same time, I remember seeing an article about the NRA, the National Rifle Association, teetering on bankruptcy, they claimed.
Well, yeah, apparently that is true. They might be losing members. I know that the number of Americans who have a gun in the household has slowly been declining over the years. Gun sales have been up. Look, when Obama was elected, people rushed to the stores to buy guns because they thought a Democratic president would take their guns away. But it was a strange phenomenon because the percentage of households with a gun did not go up. What happened is people who had guns were buying more guns. These are gun rights activists. Well, gun rights is enshrined in the American Constitution. It's the Second Amendment. I've often gone to gun shows just to talk to people and find out how their thinking is. And you know, what they'll tell you is your gun protects your individual freedom. If they take away your gun, you literally become less free. And as a result, they see that as a cherished individual right. That their view is the government cannot be abusive. The government cannot be tyrannical. They'll even say some unbelievable things, like if Jews had guns in Europe, there would have been no Holocaust. If African Americans had guns in the South, there would have been no slavery. They honestly believe that guns are their last protection against a tyrannical and abusive government. And that view is very powerful in this country.
Their statement, guns don't kill people, people kill people, but people use guns to kill people, is the missing part of that statement.
That's exactly right. It's very hard to kill people if you don't have a weapon.
This is very true. So I keep coming back to, what's the answer? How do we fix it? Is it fixable, or should we give up?
I never think we should give up. You know, I used to be asked about the division in the country back in the 1990s, and I said, well, one thing that would work, which no one would wish for, is a great national trauma, a crisis, something that brings Americans together. We had one on 9/11 in the year 2001. That crisis did bring Americans together for exactly 1 year. Democrats don't believe this, but I have the evidence that for 1 year after 9/11, a majority of Democrats supported President George W. Bush. The country did pull together. Exactly a year after 9/11, President Bush began the rollout of the war in Iraq. That started in September 2002, after Labor Day. And when that started, then all the old divisions suddenly reappeared, and you saw all the old hatreds suddenly reappear. And the division was the same as it had been decades before over the war in Vietnam. You know, then I said, well, maybe the answer will be some charismatic national leader, a great hero. We used to elect generals a lot, like General Eisenhower, the victor in World War II in Europe, General Grant, General Washington. We haven't elected generals in a long time because we haven't had that many big victories in wartime. But a great national hero might be able to bring the country together, a charismatic figure. Well, that's what Obama proposed to be. He said, he was the one who said there's no liberal or conservative America, there's just the United States of America. He failed too. After each of the last four presidents, the country became more and more and more divided. You can show that statistically using the Gallup poll, but the country has become more divided. Trump was different. He never promoted himself as a healer. He didn't propose to bring the country together at all. He exploited the division of the country, and he's made it worse, and he governs by dividing.
Politics has also become very uncivil. It's been said Republicans fight dirty, and we've got people like Michelle Obama saying we got to fight clean. We got to fight the high road. What do you think about that?
What I think is Democrats are getting very frustrated, and a lot of them are calling into question Michelle Obama's famous saying that when they go low, we go high. Well, the former Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, said when they go low, you don't go high, you kick them. You have to fight them the way they fight us, he was saying, trying to speak for Democrats. Democrats are very frustrated, and that's the choice they're going to have to face in 2020. Do they want to nominate a Democratic Donald Trump who can get down and dirty and fight Donald Trump where he is? Or do they want someone who can be civil, who wants to offer hope and inspiration? You know, we had a couple of very good presidents who offered hope and inspiration, even in bad times. One of them was Ronald Reagan. The country was in bad shape in 1980 at the end of a decade of inflation and recession. And Ronald Reagan talked about a shining city on a hill. He offered hope. He offered inspiration. And so did Barack Obama, who took office during a terrible financial crisis when people thought the country was going into a new depression. Hope became the key word behind his campaign. Well, hope is very rare to find these days in our politics. It's mostly hatred. It's mostly division and accusations. So Democrats might look for someone, one direction they could go is to look for someone who offers hope and inspiration. And that's what a lot of Democrats see in the candidate for Senate, Beto O'Rourke in Texas. Or they could go in the direction of looking for a street fighter like Michael Avenatti, someone who can fight with Trump on his own turf. That's a major choice the Democrats are going to have to face.
And if they don't make the right choice?
They don't make the right choice, Trump gets reelected, and you're going to see huge frustration. He'll get a second term, and what he'll do in his second term, Democrats don't want to even imagine, but he probably will get that wall built. And if he gets that wall built, which Republicans are talking about doing after the midterm this year, if that wall ever goes up, I guarantee you that Democratic candidates for president, and I'm sure there'll be 20 of them, maybe 30, running for 2020. They're going to rush to the wall. They're going to hold campaign rallies at that wall, and they're all going to say the same thing. They're going to stand up before a crowd of people, and they're going to say, Mr. President, tear down this wall.
Words do come back to bite you.
That's right.
Well, I've recently read Senator McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, is planning to introduce a $5 billion bill to fund the wall.
That's right, because it was what Trump was elected on. And if Republicans keep control of Congress, they'll give $5 billion and probably a lot more than that to build the wall. I'm not sure it's ever going to be completely built, because one of the problems is that the wall has to go along the Rio Grande in Texas, and a lot of that property is private property. And you're going to have court cases for years, people who claim the government is seizing their land without the title to do so. They're going to be fighting about the property rights for a long time. But that's the main issue that got Trump elected. It was resentment of immigration, illegal immigration particularly, but generally the president looks for limits on legal immigration. That was the issue that got him elected. And he doesn't want to stand for re-election in 2020 with no evidence that he could deliver. Look, this president had a lot of support from Christian conservatives. He's not exactly a model of the Christian conservative values and lifestyle, but they supported him with enthusiasm, And look what's happening. He delivers for them. They're getting what they want, a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, hundreds of conservative judges, federal judges appointed all over the country. He got that minister released just this weekend from jail in Turkey. He delivers what they want on education, a great, more friendly attitude towards private schools, which are often religious schools. He's delivering a lot for them. And as far as they're concerned, they're not worried about his morals. They see him as someone who does what he promised and delivers for them. And they're very happy even with his policies towards Israel, because a lot of Christian conservatives are more enthusiastic about Israel than even Jewish voters.
But at the same time, here's a president who promised Saudi Arabia a difficult life, shall we say, if in fact they had that journalist killed. And at the same time, he's signing off on a delivery of a whole bunch of interesting weapons to Saudi Arabia, speaking out of both sides of his mouth.
That's right. He sees Saudi Arabia as a great opportunity for the United States. He wants the Saudis to play a central role in the Middle East. You know, Saudi Arabia is the least populist country in the world. I mean, it's governed by a king, and it's governed by religious authorities. You wouldn't think they have anything in common with the United States, because we are the most populist country in the world. But the fact is, he wants to make deals with Saudi Arabia. They have a lot of money, and he wants to promote American businesses there. He also sees Saudi Arabia that could be at the forefront of some kind of peace deal between the Arabs and Israel. He's looking to build a coalition of Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, maybe Egypt, maybe Jordan, that can actually make a deal for peace with Israel. He also sees Saudi Arabia as the leader of an Arab world force that can resist Iran. Iran is not an Arab country, but it's an expansionist country and an enemy of the United States, and has been since the late 1970s. He sees Saudi Arabia as a counterweight to Iran. It's a very important country in his calculation of how the world should be run. And so the result is, when they commit the act, apparently, of murder that they just committed, and there's a huge amount of pressure from Congress for the United States to stand up to the Saudis and to threaten them and to punish them, which the president says he will do if the crime is ever confirmed, which the Turks say it is, this could spoil a lot of his plans for the Middle East.
And spoil his reelection?
Well, if there's a war breaking out, if it looks like the United States has provoked unnecessary conflict, yeah, that could spoil his reelection. Foreign affairs has never been right at the top of his agenda. He's been mostly a leader to get the United States to withdraw from the world. He feels that the United States is overcommitted, that we're trying to do too much for the rest of the world. So he has a sort of isolationist impulse. So do most Americans. Most Americans believe that much of what we do for the rest of the world is unappreciated and unrewarded. Well, the fact is that the United States has played a very special role in the world since World War II. Before World War II, we were an isolationist power. We kept to ourselves. But after World War II, with the rise of world communism that was a threat to the United States and to the rest of the free world, the United States under Harry Truman stepped to the forefront. When Britain was so weak, we said, we'll lead the free world in a global confrontation with communism. And ever since then, whenever there's a threat to international order or to humanitarian values, as there was in Kosovo in the Balkans when they had ethnic cleansing, whenever there's a threat to order or to humanitarian values, if the United States doesn't do anything, nothing happens. The world falls apart and ends up in chaos. That rule is still true, but the United States has decided to become more passive. It's withdrawing from the world. Trump has taken us out of many important treaties in the world, and he's raised questions about the UN and about NATO, where he thinks the United States' money is very often wasted. And in some cases, he's absolutely right. Who's stepping in with the United States creating a vacuum? Mainly China. China has become a far more aggressive world power than they were 5 or 10 years ago.
And in becoming a far more aggressive world power, doesn't that make China more of a threat to America?
Yes, it does. But the problem is, they depend on the American economy for their economy. They hold a lot of debt from the United States. But if the United States economy doesn't do well, the Chinese don't do well either. So they have a vested interest in us in doing well, because it's one of the strengths on which they build their own economy. But they're stepping in the South China Sea in the developing world. They are producing aid. They're building public works projects because the United States is stepping back from its world leadership role.
Why'd you write the book?
I'm sorry, what did you ask?
Why did you write the book?
It's because it's the culmination of my life. It's my life story. I've been involved in politics since I was in college in the 1960s. I remember I was at a liberal university, Brandeis University. We had a mock Republican convention in 1964. I was the chairman of that convention. That was the year the Republicans nominated Barry Goldwater. Of course, at Brandeis University, most of the students were from New York. We nominated Nelson Rockefeller. The party nominated Barry Goldwater. And I remember Leonard Hall, who was at the time the chairman of the Republican Party, was there as the keynote speaker. And I asked him after he spoke, how did Barry Goldwater win the nomination of the Republican Party? That was the beginning of the Republican march to the right. And he said, the people who voted for Barry Goldwater are people who stay until the ends of meetings. I always thought that was a very important idea, that they're committed, that they have a powerful sense of ideology, and that has been true even recently with the Tea Party. Those are people who stay till the ends of meetings, and you find them on the right and also on the left. And that's what's making politics so bitter.
I was going to say, do Democrats stay till the end of the meeting?
Some do, increasing numbers. There are a lot more progressives, and they have a louder voice in the Democratic Party. A lot of them didn't trust Hillary Clinton. They thought she was a sellout. They saw her as a charter member of the Washington political establishment, and that's true. She is. I mean, she was first lady for 8 years and senator and secretary of state, and they don't like the Washington political establishment. They want to do whatever they can to bring it down, which is what Donald Trump proposed to do. So you find a lot of pressure on Democrats from the progressive left. It hasn't taken over the party quite as much as conservatives have taken over the Republican Party, particularly with Donald Trump. You know, when he won the nomination in 2016, it was a big shock to a lot of Republicans because he's not the kind of Republican they favor. But they've fallen in line behind Donald Trump because he's angry, because he's determined to wipe out Democratic Party influences. He wants to destroy everything President Obama did, starting with Obamacare, all the treaties that he signed. You know, we're in this situation now with two political forces, the left and the right, really in lunging to gain power and to eradicate everything the other side does. That's a very unfortunate situation, but it's where we are in politics today.
So the answer is simply to make sure you register to vote and go vote no matter what you think.
The important thing is to vote. If you don't vote, then you have no say in the matter, and you have no real right to complain because you didn't participate.
Participation is, in fact, everything. And I want to say thank you to my guest this morning, my guest, author of the new book, How America Became Ungovernable.
Stand Up.
Pardon? Stand Up.
The title is Stand Up.
Oh. How? Do you have a website?
I don't have my own website, no. But the book was published by Simon & Schuster.
All right. And I want to thank you to my guest as well, Bill Schneider, his new book, How America Became Ungovernable. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
And it's been another edition of Conversation here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. More in just, we'll be back after this message. And we're back, and there it goes, another edition of Conversation here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. I want to say thanks one more time to Bill Schneider, his new book, Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. If you want the standoff to end, please remember to go vote. We don't ask much of you as a citizen. Pay your taxes and vote. And if you want to say in how your tax money gets spent, vote. I can't say it enough. Vote, vote, vote. Stay tuned for WIP Sunday. If you can't, nothing left to say, but see you soon. Good morning, and the conversation continues here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio as we ease on into WIP Sunday. And a chilly WIP morning it is here at 94 WIP. We're going into the middle 60s, so no matter where you go, make sure you take a sweater or a jacket and take WIP with you, 94 WIP, hot conversation, no matter who's on the air. And when we come back in just a bit, conversation expert, I guess that's the way to describe him, conversation expert, James Pyle. He's one of the authors of a new book, Control the Conversation, How to Charm, Deflect, and Defend Your Position Through Any Line of Questions. Whether you're a talker, you're going to the boss for a raise, or whether you're watching a politician on television, how to know what's going on and what's up. All this and more when we come back here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon, the WIP time, 701. Conversation, it's the currency of life. Whether you're dealing with your boss, your spouse, politics, neighbors, friends. Control the conversation, how to charm, deflect, and defend your position through any line of questions. He's got important information we need to consider. And with that in mind, I want to say good morning to my guest this morning, James Pyle. James's new book is the Control the Conversation. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Peter Solomon.
Controlling the conversation, is this a natural skill or one that can be developed, or both?
Well, first of all, I'm not in my natural element this morning to be up this early to talk with you. The sun's not even up. I don't know how you do this every day. But I am glad to be with you and to talk with you and your listeners. The thing about conversation, and you said something very important just 36 seconds ago, it is a currency that we expend to get what we want, do what we want to do, know what we need to know.
All right. But is it born or is it made? Can you, or both?
Well, yes. Yes, the answer to that, of course, is because we have a certain ability. But some people need to have that ability sharpened, a little more focused, and sometimes we need a little more assistance. So it should be a learned concept, and a lot of folks, if they just relax, could do it a lot better.
A lot of us get our ideas about controlling conversation from watching police procedurals. I've been binge-watching Law & Order SUV lately, and there's a lot of controlled conversations going on in that show. Of course, it helps to have a scriptwriter.
Well, of course. And there's a lot of scripted stuff out there these days, even the Kavanaugh hearings. But really, not controlling the conversation as in a fist hold, but more of managing the information flow, more of managing the direction, more of, if you have something that you want somebody to know, how to make sure you can make that happen in an environment like you're asking me questions, I'm giving you answers. Your show is called Conversation, and that's what we wanted to move to. We don't want to stay in question, answer. That's just data. What we want to have is a conversation, which is warmed up information, which is personal information exchanged. And I saw a picture of you, and I realized that you and I are probably very contemporary. You're a little more handsome than I am, but we've both been around a while, and you do what you do very well, and probably don't even need to know what I know.
Sure we do. Absolutely sure we do. Sometimes I'm a very bad conversationalist, and my brain freezes. Maybe that has something to do with being up early in the morning, but that's another
right,
discussion.
Right, right, right.
All right.
But I've been blessed with a good forgetter. That's my problem.
Does anybody you can point to who does it right?
Wow. I like your question. There are people who you can listen to, who you want to listen to, and I can't say in a national venue. I just think of people I know personally who make me feel comfortable, who help me converse. But I wouldn't be able to tell you just offhand anybody that does it well. But I will say that Larry King, he's a great questioner. But the one thing he does that I advocate is that he doesn't
read the book if you're going to be on his show. He doesn't find out about you before the show. He finds out about you during the show. And discovery is the key to really enhance the conversation. I want to know what you know, and I wouldn't know if I didn't ask.
All right, well, then let me find out about you. What brings you to the table to write this book?
A conversation I had with my youngest daughter. I have five children. And she had gone to an interview for a national release commercial that she was qualified for because they were looking for a young girl who rides horses and comfortable with animals. And she was certainly a good choice for that. And they called her in for an interview. I was out of town down in North Carolina at the time. When I came back, I said, "Kiddo, how'd it go?" And she said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "What do you mean you don't know?" She said, "Well, they asked me questions, and I told them the answer." And right then and there, I realized that children, especially young people, are conditioned to just give an answer, which is data. And data will not get you a job. Data will not get you, the position you want. And so I realized then, after I'd been spending most of my life training people to ask questions, Marianne Crunch and I co-authored a book back in 2014 called Find Out Anything from Anybody Anytime, and it's all about asking good questions and getting good information, that I realized that I could step through the mirror, look back, and see how to manage that information that people are looking for.
Is part of conversation how you look, tone of voice?
Of course. Otherwise, it's just, it could be done, on a typewriter or on the keyboard. You want to be sincere and convincing if you believe in what you're saying and what you're trying to present. And I personally assess, look, and listen, but I isolate it. And for instance, the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. When I came out of work the very day that they were conducted, I turned off my radio in the car. I didn't watch TV until I went home, and I watched it on C-SPAN, 523 minutes of it, uninterrupted. It didn't end for me till 3:30 the next morning. But I took that as a single event, and then I go back, and then I watch it without the audio, and I look for what people call body language. I look for that definition. I look for that expression, and I get something from that that tells me what I feel and what my gut tells me. And then I'm working on now to go back and just to listen to it, to isolate it, as if I were blind, without any audio, without any video to interpret visually. Listening to it and watching it only is the way that the deaf would do, or the way the blind would do, and they're the best at body language, and they're the best to be able to listen for what's really, really said.
Who did it best in the Kavanaugh hearings then?
Can't say. All I can say is that it really comes down to there was no discovery there. That's what was missing. There was no questions for discovery. There's only questions to prove a point and or to make a point. And so that the prepared environment was impossible to really evaluate in a who did or who didn't do better. It was he said, she said, they said. Also, he didn't say, she didn't say, they didn't say. That's the big picture of what happened that day. And it was great political theater, with a lot of positioning politically, some hurtful personal results, and I'm a little afraid of the national implications, because this thing doesn't seem to want to go away for the divisiveness that it seems to have brought to play.
Well, but there are those people who would say, when Brett Kavanaugh lost it and started shouting and carrying on, and asked the one senator, "She ever been drunk?" That he lost a lot of...
Oh, yeah. There were some very poor responses. Some very what you and I would never do, most likely. But the one thing I thought was most interesting, and of course they called in body language experts all over the place, you know, Fox and NBC and everybody else. But I thought, for my money, after the first break, that we got to see Dr. Ford in her most relaxed environment when she put her glasses back on her head and she looked around. I think we saw the real Dr. Ford there for a few minutes, and she was a more interesting person to watch at that moment after the break, with her glasses up and her engaging everybody without the nervousness that she seems to have.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a binge watcher of Law and Order, and there's a lot of coaching of witnesses. Don't let the other side make you crazy and get you riled up.
Sure, sure, sure.
Good advice or bad advice.
But for the most part in Law and Order and such as that, they're questioning for a prosecution. They're not trying to discover. They're not trying to interpret as much as I would like to think that the questioning should be. I'm a retired Army interrogator, and a lot of people think a lot of things when they hear that word interrogator, but it's just asking questions. And you were a great interrogator when you were 2 years old, and so was I, because it was natural. We were curious. We needed to know. We asked good questions. What's that? Who's that? Why is that? And I wish that some of the people who have to know information would be that open to discover instead of to prove a point. We have great 911 operators who have to do that in seconds. They have to discover real important information right now to make a difference. And they're the best we have. Some of them have to work with scripts, but some of them are natural discoverers, and they make a difference.
But there are those people who would say a questioner, an interrogator, should never ask a question he doesn't already know the answer to.
I sometimes I would know the answer already, but I want to know what you think. I want to know what you tell me, not what I know from that somebody else has told me what happened or where it happened or how it happened or why it happened. I want you to tell me. I want to discover from you, and maybe I'll find out something more. Maybe I'll find out a better aspect of that information. Maybe I'll prove something or disprove something, but I won't go in with a point to prove.
And you're listening to 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, James Pyle, one of the authors of the book, Control the Conversation, How to Charm, Deflect, and Defend Your Position Through Any Line of Questioning. James, we need to run a few commercials. We'll be back in just a bit. The WIP
sure.
Time, 7:15. And we're back. My guest this morning, James Pyle, one of the authors of Control the Conversation, How to Charm, Deflect, and Defend Your Position Through Any Line of Questions. My name's Peter Solomon. Okay, James, give us a how-to. How do you do it? What are some things that we should, basics?
Great. You know, people ask me in questionnaires and different things for data. You know, when were you born? And that's pretty bland, and that's not very interesting. And so when people ask me when I was born, I always warm it up a little bit with something a little more. Like I'll tell them that well, I was born 5 years before rock and roll music in 1950 in a little town near St. Louis, Missouri. And the reason I say that is I want to give it some time. I want to give it some background. I want to give it some place, because there's only four things to talk about: people, places, things, and events in time. And so if you realize that there's, you know, some people say, I don't know what to say. Well, say something about people, because everybody knows somebody you know or been somewhere you've been. And so that includes the places and the things that you know, the things that you like. What's more boring than a recipe? We have beef, cheese, and a bun. But in Philadelphia, that changes because there's passion about who's Philly's Philly sub is the best. And then you have memories, and then you have something more to think about. And when I come to Philly someday again, I'm going to have me one of those sandwiches at one of those places that are across the street from each other, and probably have one from both, just because of that. So that anything can be warmed up, anything can be enhanced as far as the discussion. And so I just try to incorporate people, places, things, and events in time in all of my responses. I don't answer questions anymore. I respond to questions.
And doing that, I would imagine, catches the questioner off guard, because he's just expecting, I was born 1951.
Right, right. Yeah, so that, but it also gives the questioner something more to talk about. It enhances and it induces more conversation so that we can find commonality, so that we can define our position, so that we can get the job. You know, if you have a resume, that just tells some information about you that gets you a ticket to ride. They say, okay, I'm going to talk to this person. So you don't want to spend much time talking about what your resume says, because they already know that. What they need to know is why you do what you do, how you do what you do, and you need to make that known. I have another daughter who's the youngest of three kids from a previous marriage, and she was living in Pittsburgh last year at this time, and she had been working for 2 years to try to get another job, trying to come to D.C. area to live again, and she wasn't getting any responses to her resume. She wasn't getting any secondary interviews after the first. And when I began to write with Marianne Crinch this book this time last year, I began to share with her everything we talked about and everything that we did, because she naturally didn't speak openly. She's more unlike me. She's a little more reserved and a little more introverted. And so I had to help her come out and help her understand that she needed to be more active in the process. And now she works for NASA Goddard Space Center up in Greenbelt, and she's the happiest kid in town.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Anything else that's a basic?
Oh, that's pretty much it. Know what you know. Let people know what you know, and let them know that there's more to you than just data.
Well, here's something from my background. 1,000 years ago, when I was looking for my very first job, I was being questioned for a job in corrections and being interviewed by a panel of judges, and was being asked, would I be nervous working with this population? And I was 20 years old, and I think I was stupid, and I said yes. Obviously, that yes led to me not getting the job. I told them the truth, and the truth got me out the front door, not invited back in.
Uh-huh. What would you say now?
I'd say, I think anybody would be nervous, but I could cope with that.
Exactly what I would expect. And if I heard that, I'd say, I understand that. I can appreciate that. And that's the sell. You sell yourself in that regard. So earlier today, as I listened into one of your interviews earlier today, you talked about he can lead a horse to water, but he can't make him think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that comes from you lead a horse to water, can't make him drink.
Right.
But if you lead a horse to water and you make them thirsty, they'll drink all by themselves. And that's what I found out in sales, and that's what I found out in human intelligence and collection, is that you try to create something to get a result. And so if you make people thirsty, they'll drink by themselves. If you make the job decision boss thirsty for you, he'll hire you because he needs you. So you don't bust the door down. You make them want to invite you in. And a good conversation and managing that information, just like you said there, you said yes, that's not enough.
I should have said yes, but.
Or yeah, I'm sure I would be, because I'm that way on every job I've ever started new. But you know, I've learned to cope and I've learned to manage, and I care about people, and so from there, I don't see any problem.
Okay. But how does that work in what your former occupation was of being involved in intelligence work. You're not trying to make friends when you question somebody in intelligence, are you?
Oh, hell yeah. Excuse my French there. Oh, yeah. Why be enemies? I want to be your best buddy. I can help. I care. And I have an objective. I have a job. I have a mission. But that doesn't mean I have to be mean. I have to be enemies. I can be the best person that they are in this situation. And, you know, it's contrary to what people see on TV. It's contrary to what people see in the movies. It's contrary to what people have seen in the past. But there's more to it than bed springs and being tied to a battery of jump cables. And because what you need is accurate information, important information that has to be verifiable and not coerced, because if somebody's under duress and stress and pain, they might just tell you anything to stop that process. So a good cognitive interview interrogation is a better interview interrogation for the information that comes from it.
Okay. Switching gears, because it's a political year, certainly, with the election only a few weeks away. Is anybody do it right? Ask questions, respond to questions? I mean, I'm specifically thinking of Donald Trump and Sarah Sanders.
Well,
I know
she has the hardest job in town.
Right.
And I will tell you that an observation about Donald Trump. I've never seen a conversation with the man. I can't cite a conversation that he's had with anybody anywhere. It's always questions and answers and presentation and, you know, as far as being a president, I wish you could read the device that they have that puts up on the screen the speech and such things.
Oh, the teleprompter.
Yeah, I wish you could do teleprompter better, because he does it horribly. But as far as I'm concerned, the one person I wish would be president. And I've said this for more than 20 years, I think, is I believe that Colin Powell had probably been the best president that we could have had in a long time. But I don't think he would ever put his family through that. But I think that he does. He carries a conversation well. He does. I don't agree with all of his political views or his political stance, but I respect the man. And I respect his perspective, and I think that he does as good a job as anybody to talk and to converse.
Why? What does he do right?
He listens. 'Cause, see, that's the key to the good conversation. Most of us all have two ears and one mouth, and that's the right ratio. If I'm doing all the talking, I'm not listening as much, and I'm missing on information. So that I think he's a great listener. I think his experience has taught him to be more centered than extreme. His military experience, you know, I relate to that. I was served in the Pentagon from 1990 to 1995, and he was Commander of the Joint Chiefs, and so I served under him most directly at that time in my life. So that he's a good man, and the problem is that we don't have the best men running for office these days. And Trey Gowdy, if he were to aspire, would get my attention as well.
All right, but how about Sarah Sanders?
Sarah? God bless her. She's interesting to listen to. She manages the unmanageable, and I enjoy her conversation.
Okay. Does anybody do it particularly badly that you can point to?
Say again, please. I didn't hear well.
Does anybody do it particularly badly in your estimation?
Political stuff badly. Extreme positions are all bad no matter what. I think the reaction to extreme positions is equally bad. I don't want to go there.
Okay. I got you. I think I got you. All right. And you're listening to 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon, and we're talking with James Pyle. James is one of the authors of Control the Conversation, How to Charm, Deflect, and Defend Your Position Through Any Line of Questioning. My name's Peter Solomon. We'll be back in just a bit. And we're back. It's WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning into the home stretch, James Pyle, author of the new book, Control the Conversation. James, you talk about answer enhancers. What are those?
Oh, those are things that warm up the conversation. Any times questions and answers is in play, it's like there's styrofoam between the two people. Styrofoam doesn't let warmth out or doesn't let warmth in, and answer enhancers take that styrofoam and take it away and open up the gap so that we have some commonality. Again, it's those four things we talked about earlier: people, places, things, and events in time. We all have some commonality, and so instead of telling you that I was an Army interrogator, I might also add some other things that I've done in life. I used to sell cemetery property in Forest Lawn Memorial Park in Southern California, and I was an on-air personality at two small market radio stations in Missouri and Kentucky, and I want to grow up and be like you because I've spent most of my life, about a third of my life, training people to ask questions, and you get paid to do that and just get to do that without having to train people. You just do it. So I think I want to grow up and be like you.
All right. Tell me about how you can analyze a question, define the motivation behind it.
Oh, well, the best way to know what's coming at you as far as a question is to know who's asking the question. If it's a job interview, you want to know the business. That doesn't mean you have to know, you know, how the business runs, who runs the business, that kind of thing. But you have to be familiar with it so that you'll understand where they're coming from and what they're looking for. Like in a job interview. But if you listen to the question, sometimes there's a pejorative statement in that question. They're going to say, so how do you really feel about the government separating children at the border? That doesn't sound like, so what do you think about the border separation these days? Which is a little more, neutral, but you listen for that edge, that what they're looking for, either you're with me or against me, kind of question.
Yeah, I don't usually tell jokes on the air, but I'm going to ask you a joke, give you a joke, and ask you to react to it.
Okay.
What's the worst thing a Hollywood actor wants to hear?
I have no idea.
Ronan Farrow on line one.
Okay.
All right, Ronan Farrow, the big expose writer of.
Don't want to be standing by for that.
Yeah, but you're going to be damned if you do talk to him and damned if you don't.
Well, yeah, so what? So you just do what you do and let it be. And that's a part of life, too. You can't make everything the way you want it to be, so you just roll with the flow and go where the lonely go, to quote Merle Haggard.
But is there a way to respond to a Ronan Farrow-like question without getting yourself in deep doo-doo?
Keep it light. Okay. Keep it don't make it personal. Keep it professional. And decline to answer if it's something that would be hurtful. Offer up alternatives to try to redirect it away from what maybe is the direction, and just be aware.
Okay. And how do you use a question to answer a question? Because you talk about that.
Okay. Well, you know, the worst thing that Brett Kavanaugh did was ask the same question back. And if you're going to use a question after a question, make it your question. Let's see if I can make sense of that. And so someone asked me, so, it's hard for me to make up questions because I'm so, you know, involved with it to do it independently here just on the spot. But try to not just ask that question back, which sometimes the purpose of that is to give yourself a little time to think.
Mm-hmm. It's a staller.
Yeah, and so what you can do is use a little warm-up saying, I like that question. I like your question. Instead of saying that's a good question, because a good question is just a mere construct of words. But when it comes to your question, that's a warmer exchange. So I like your question, Peter. But use the question and say, so let me get this straight. You're asking me, and then you can rephrase that question to be, is that the way you want to ask that? Is that what you want me to know or want to know from me? So that those things give you time to think about your response.
But if someone uses a stalling question, is that a bad thing or a good thing or a neutral thing?
It gets my attention. It gets my attention.
Makes you ask, why is he stalling?
Because some people's they're managing the information that they're going to give me. It doesn't mean they're going to lie. It just means they're managing how much they're going to tell me or what they're going to tell me. And or it might be a lie, you know. It doesn't matter to me, but I pay attention to what changes. When they start to make a statement and then they pause, they are managing what they want to tell me, and I'm just paying attention to what they say because that's important, because it might be what they didn't say is equally important.
You know, people ask me how I do this every Sunday in particular, and I say, because I can't possibly read all the books that I get.
No.
So I say it's like a cocktail party, and if I can't talk to anybody about anything for at least 20 minutes, shame on me.
Well, you know, you're easy to talk with, Peter. And I want to tell you that you have a voice twin in Sierra Vista, Arizona, a friend of mine. That I feel like I'm talking to a friend of mine who lives in Sierra Vista, Arizona. You have the same voice. You have the same cadence. You have the same smile in your voice that he does.
Thank you. I appreciate the compliment. Now, body language. I know that's more your co-author's area than yours. But how important is body language?
Well, she's a co-author also with a gentleman by the name of Greg Hartley. They've written, I think, 5 books together now. And he used to be my roommate in Monterey, California, when we were both in the Army at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. That's tough duty. And he is my go-to guy for body language, and Marianne Krench has learned from him as well. And we're kind of a gang of three from time to time. But body language is important. It's how we survive all these millennium because we see what we need to see to verify and validate what we hear. And if you're looking away from me and you're nervous about what we're talking about and what we're talking about is very important, I need to find out why you're nervous and allow you that nervousness, that fear to get to the truth.
All right. You're in the boss's office, though, when he's questioning you about something related to work. You sit back in the chair straight up like you have a stick up to whatever, and you're answering all his questions. Good thing or bad thing to sit like that?
I'm going to mirror. I'm not going to sit like me. I'm going to sit like him. And if he's erect and straight, I'm going to be as much like him as I can be and still be me. If he's casual, got his feet up on the desk, I'm going to be a little more relaxed and be a little more open, because that helps him to feel comfortable with me, because I am looking like he feels, if that makes any sense.
It absolutely does. How about if you're sitting in the chair like it's a Barca lounger?
Well, of course, right now, see, I'm sitting with my feet up, and I'm laid back talking to you, holding the phone in my hand. You're sitting in the studio in front of a microphone, and so we're very different right now. But we are joined as voices, and we are equal.
Okay. But if you're with the boss,
yeah,
and he's sitting at his desk looking businesslike, and you're acting like you're home in the Barca lounger.
That's not working. Not working. Unless that's your job, to sell Barca loungers.
Okay. Hands clasped to each other in your lap. Good thing or bad thing?
There's no good or bad. It is just what is. And some people interpret too much into body language. It should be what's normal for me. That might be my normal position. It would be unfortunate if people interpret that as defensive or shielding or, nervous or defensive, if that's my norm. So that the thing about body language is you can't interpret what you see until you have a normal baseline.
Okay.
And that's what's wrong with the people interpreting what they saw so much in the judicial hearings, is that there's no baseline to these two individuals. Matter of fact, nobody had ever seen Dr. Christine Ford before and since. And so we don't have any context of her person, and we just seen that presentation. Same way with Brett Kavanaugh. Most of us haven't seen him before. Now we're seeing more of him afterwards. But to get a context of him, that's not enough. That those few hours is not enough to get who his baseline is, so that people react and respond to what they saw maybe not as accurate as to what really is.
And I have a friend whose father, he always sat with his arms folded over his chest.
Mm-hmm.
Good thing, a bad thing, or again, one of those indeterminates.
That might be just how they're comfortable. Just be their comfort position. So we have to, if you say it's always that way, I would pay attention to him if he wasn't.
Okay.
That would get my attention, is if he changed his position during our conversation, I would say, why?
Or sitting with his arms folded across his chest with a scowl on his face.
Now, there we have more than one thing to look at. And, we've all interpreted body language growing up from our parents and our siblings, and we learned a lot. We knew when things were good. We knew when things were going south. And we knew when things were bad. Because of what we saw, not always because of what we heard.
How do you want people to use the book?
I'd like for them to learn to relax, to get a plan, to enhance their conversation so that they realize that more can be learned and more can be exchanged by just adding a few more nuances to how they converse. And I'm going to steal this from you this day when you talked about it being our currency. That really is, it struck me like a lightning bolt when you said that I never thought of it that way. It's how we do business. And if you want to do business better, you need to invest in that currency.
Okay, so it's a book we all should read when we deal with our boss, our spouse, our friends, whoever.
Anybody.
But it seems to me it's also a book, and forgive me if I'm perverting the purpose of your book, that anybody in the prison ought to take a look at if they want to be a better criminal.
Well, I'm sure that like anything in the world, anything that's good can be turned to bad by somebody figuring out a way to do it. It's just money is a good thing. But people can handle it poorly. I certainly never thought about somebody taking this and using it in a negative way. So maybe your question has opened up an area of concern that I didn't have before.
Yeah, you might want to think about it. But at the same time, it's all in how you use the information.
Absolutely.
That's the key point. What's next? Another book?
Well, yes. just to finish the conversation last week, because most people think that body language is scientific in its nature completely and probably isn't interesting at all and is hard to understand. And I have a concept on body language that I'd like to present to people based on animation and animated movies, because animators are the greatest body language experts in the world. And they show us great body language in movies, animated movies, and I've been watching them since I was a kid. And if you have kids at home, you have to watch them because they're going to watch them. So why don't we learn from them while we're watching them some things that the animators want us to know, and then how to apply that.
It sounds like a book every parent, especially every parent whose kids watch a Disney movie, might want to check out.
They're the best body language presenters that I can tell you about. And I watch a movie, and then I watch it again without the sound so that I get just the visual, and then I listen to the movie with just the audio, with no visual. And what that does for me enhances my ability to read and understand and then later apply what I've learned.
One last question. Do you have a website?
I do not.
Okay.
I just write them and
put them out there.
Go for there, yeah.
And I'd like to say thank you to James Pyle, his new book, Control the Conversation. It's well worth taking a look at. Thank you, James. And it's been another edition of WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sunny Hill. Always interesting and provocative discussion in the living room. It's chilly out there, so stay warm. Thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer, and Ann Tideman Solomon, my dear wife and associate producer. Couldn't do the show without either one of you. Nothing left to say, but talk to you soon.